In the new book, Bone of the Bone, Sarah Smarsh brings her storytelling and critique to the challenges that define our times: class division, political fissures, gender inequality, environmental crisis, media bias, the rural-urban gulf. Smarsh, a journalist who grew up on a wheat farm in Kansas and was the first in her family to graduate from college, has long focused on cultural dissonance that many in her industry neglected until recently. Her essays on topics as varied as the socioeconomic significance of dentistry, laws criminalizing poverty, fallacies of the red versus blue political framework, working as a Hooters girl, and much more are an important addition to any discussion on contemporary America. Sarah Smarsh is a journalist who has reported for The New York Times, Harper's Magazine, and The Guardian, and it is a great pleasure to welcome Sarah Smarsh to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. What a great pleasure to have you on our program.
Hi, Joe. It's a pleasure to be with you. Thanks.
So let's begin with the obvious. What do you make of this past week? A lot of these essays do deal with our political times, with red versus blue, and I'm curious on these days after a major election of what you're left thinking.
Well, I have to say, the political landscape continues, I believe, to validate a point that I've been making some time in my work, for some time in my writing, which is that class, socioeconomic class, is an under-discussed, under-examined, ill-understood, misarticulated, often aspect of American identity, and how the two parties of our two-party system handle that topic or don't is predicting election outcomes, I believe.
Why are we so bad at it, do you think?
Well, I think you have to go back to the very founding of this nation to answer that question. It's deep in the American psyche to perceive ourselves or fancy ourselves, perhaps even, as a meritocracy. Our history as a nation state involves breaking away from a monarchy and rejecting an overt class system for a system in which, despite having been flawed in myriad ways along lines like race and gender, if we're talking about democracy, nonetheless, the overall idea about the country and its ideals and aspirations involved anybody can make a go of it here. If you work hard, then you'll receive your due reward. In fact, all along, there has been a class system underlying the realities of Americans, and that class system intersects with race and gender, to be sure. But I think that we're just now, and because of our moment of historic wealth inequality, being forced to reckon with the distance between how we've thought about ourselves in relationship to class and what's actually going on.
You have a piece in the book called "How Is Arguing with Trump Voters Working Out for You?" This was a piece that was written in 2020 for The Guardian. And you write, many white people believe the current president is a good man. Are they irrational? Sometimes perhaps even disturbed. If they have valid news sources, then by my estimation, yes. But many do not. They live in spaces inundated by decades of right-wing propaganda and the intentional manipulation of their fears. Would you say anything has changed since writing that 4 years ago?
I don't think anything has changed. And to relate your point to the reflection I was just offering about class, that very successful messaging and often in the form of right-wing propaganda has very specifically and keenly been pointed toward the class concern, the class question, and spoken to the often due and understandable economic grievances of all sorts of groups, and including, of course, the white working class. And so that messaging has been very successful, whether it's full of lies or not. For some years, the Republicans have been quite far ahead of Democrats in just the matter of validating those concerns. And if someone's hurting, that sense of validation goes a long way.
And when you, we saw it in this campaign, and it started out of a place with generals of all people saying that the former president was a fascist. And then suddenly we're in a situation where we're asking voters who have every intention to vote for Donald Trump if they are Nazis or fascists. You touch on this in that particular piece. I'm curious as to how we get away from that in this time, especially with what the Trump win has for it this time that it did not have for it have with it the last time, which is the winning of the popular vote.
Yes, and not only that, but also notable gains among racial minority groups, specifically within the working class, I believe. I think that those shifts tell us that. For one, it's complicated, and if a lot of people have been scratching their heads and saying, please explain Trump. We're going on a decade now where there isn't one tidy, easy answer that sums it all up. So first we have to acknowledge that within that extremely sizable group who cast a ballot for Trump, there certainly are folks among them who like the guy because of his authoritarianism, because of his fascist tendencies and his autocratic aspirations. Also within that group, I believe, are people with perhaps much better intentions who are not as well informed. Also within that group are people who perhaps fear his autocratic tendencies and have made a calculation that by their estimation, for let's say economic reasons, they feel more secure voting for him and kind of rolling the dice on some other very dangerous matters. So half of the American electorate Nazis, to answer your question, for someone from that political angle who perceives Trump and his movement that way, certainly not. By my estimation, those ideas are mixed in with the broader coalition or cohort, and the gains that party and that movement have made, I think maybe more so than causing us to continue asking how and why and who and about that side should perhaps suggest that Democrats or liberals, progressives, even moderates, folks who have rejected that movement, take a look at themselves in the mirror and ask, not what did the other side do, but what did we not do? And I would offer, and not as an excuse, as someone who happens to be a progressive who finds that movement reprehensible in a lot of ways, but I would certainly offer this as a reason. I very rarely heard the Democrats use the term working class. They certainly made some overtures and some moves in the right direction in this campaign, by my estimation. But still, just talking about that concern in a very pointed way continues to elude that party, and I think they're paying for it.
You write in a Instagram post that was posted yesterday, I believe, that said, I've said all I have to say about politics, which is just a reflection of a deeper condition. Earth, what would you have me say? Earth replied, heal. This is after you say that you Just took a walk yesterday to instead of reading the news and looking at what the Earth would have you do. I'm curious as how you see that, not what you went through personally in that moment, but what you see beneficial in that gesture for us as many of us try to figure out the next step forward.
Oh, well, thank you for the opportunity to reflect in that way. You know, I'm a trained journalist, and often I find myself wearing a commentator hat. But ultimately, at the deepest core of what I do, writing about my family, my community, my background, is to attempt to help readers make the connection between what's going on in our hearts and minds and our most intimate and private experiences and the government and the structures that ultimately are just an extension of and a reflection of who we are as a people. And while it may often seem like who is representing us in a governmental sense couldn't be farther from who we are on the ground, and that's true in a lot of ways, it's also true, as we've been just grappling with, that more than half of the American electorate voted for Donald Trump. And what does that mean about the core of our country and the people contained therein? And my read is that there are a lot of people in pain. I never wish intend for that idea again to serve as an excuse for any sort of vote or political direction that ultimately may bring harm to all sorts of marginalized people. But it is nonetheless a reason, and that pain has everything to do, I believe, with the historic wealth inequality that we're struggling with. It goes to the core, the very primal core of a person's fear about survival. I lived with food insecurity at times during my childhood, also housing insecurity, and I know what that can do to people is put them kind of back on their heels in a fearful place, which isn't always a rational space for decision making, but it's an understandable, an understandable compromise of what may otherwise, in better circumstances, be someone's ideal. So, it's not, by the way, new. There's a great historical precedent for a moment like this then leading in the direction of authoritarianism or the choosing of autocratic leaders. I think we need to look at how the American people are hurting and why. And yes, race and gender and all sorts of identity markers that we have rightly, hopefully, been beginning to reckon with in recent decades. Mm. But the class thing, boy, we've got to put it front and center right now.
Sarah Smarsh is our guest. The name of the new book is Bone of the Bone, Essays on America by a Daughter of the Working Class. So you're still living in Kansas, and I'm interested because of the subjects that you write about in the collection, that there does seem to be, and especially on that working class, that once that's in you, that doesn't leave, does it? I mean, that's very much at your core.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, class is a funny thing. Unlike other aspects of identity that might have to do with your physical person, you know, race, the color of your skin, your ethnicity, your sex, biological sex, the matter of class is a little bit more slippery. It can be, it can change over the course of a lifetime. Maybe you're born with a lot of money and then you lose it all, or vice versa. There's a way in which one can hold simultaneously a lot of different class experiences and narratives. And so in my case, I started out in rural poverty, and I now make a middle-class living as an author and a journalist and have very different economic outcomes than the folks in my community and my family, to be sure. And nonetheless, that kind of original imprint of poverty and working class experience, I carry with me in my psyche and even to some extent in my body. And I think that's true for, it looks different for everyone, but I think it's true for all of us that it's in many ways a lens through which we see the world. Even when that lens changes, now maybe you're carrying multiple class narratives simultaneously.
When you look at those narratives, it seems like it's often hard for people to realize anything outside of their own, right? I mean, that's one of the beautiful things about reading your work. It's fascinating, but we often are in our own bubble, and it's hard to, it seems that what so often is lacking is empathy for anyone who has a different position than you do.
I think that's right. And it's one of the reasons, you know, to go back to this notion of how I personally carry more than one narrative or truth simultaneously used to be somewhat painful for me. I had a sense that I didn't quite belong in the place that I was from because of where I had ended up academically and professionally. And on the other side of that coin, when I was in any given professional space, I didn't quite belong because of where I was from. That tension used to be kind of painful for me and disconcerting. I now actually see it as a strength and a vantage that allows me to understand firsthand more than one class experience. I think that might be true for a lot of people, that they're bridge people of sorts across different bubbles, if you will, whether that's because they've moved geographic region within the United States, or it might even be that their sexual orientation or gender identification has changed. But when the circumstances and the contours and the choices of your life allow you to now kind of be in a different social environment, perhaps a different geographic environment, you might think of yourself as again a bridge person of sorts, and we sure need all of those that we can get right now in this moment of severe polarization that you were just alluding to.
The idea of what you went through and looking, I mean, do you see Kansas as really the best place for you to be? Will it always be the home?
Yeah. For sure, it'll always be home. It's the it's the best place for my body and my mind and my soul to be, in terms of just feeling that sense of ease and comfort, knowing where I'm from and where it feels good, where the air smells right and the sunlight looks like I feel that it should. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's the right calculation in other terms. And in our industrialized and urbanized world, I no doubt have at points along my path probably left some money on the table and left some good opportunities on the table in economic terms to be where I'm at. But those aren't necessarily the only values by which we can choose where to hang our hat. And so I do feel good about my choice. And it's actually allowed me as a journalist in an industry that I don't have to tell you has, struggled in the digital era in terms of loss of media outlets, largely in rural areas and throughout the middle of the country, allowed me to be of service in a sense to my industry because of the place that I've chosen also for personal reasons.
I love to just explore that idea about journalism, because what we hear is obviously on the national scale, it is so difficult and so corporate, and so many sources are dying. And yet we talk about the small town papers, and that local news in many places is if not flourishing, is at least surviving. And I'm interested in what your view is on that, and is that what you see and feel that you can even help in that regard?
Well, you're right that heroic local journalism persists despite all manner of threats and economic challenges in specifically the digital era. And, you know, I tip my hat to all of those persevering local media outlets. It is also true, certainly, though, that newspapers specifically have been falling by the hundreds annually, and I see that in my home state. You know, places that used to have someone covering the county commission meeting don't anymore, that, I think, has everything to do with the discussion we've been having about our political moment, in that this kind of sense of being untethered or unmoored from a shared media ecosystem or conversation that was true just a generation ago, and being more kind of scattered and split in our you know, media diets or information intakes, is of course a result of our digital and social media era, and that allows for I believe a vulnerability to propaganda, and also, to go back to that notion about how people are hurting, just a greater longing and desire to feel seen and validated in their lives. If you don't have a local newspaper, you know, kind of putting your kid's picture on page 3B from the basketball game, then a sense of invisibility among a certain class might feel even more pronounced. And then in comes national media outlets, often in, always based in coastal urban centers, often with even sometimes well-meaning, but certainly frequently get misguided takes on the place that you're from. That's kind of a perfect storm for feeling alienated from media, and then thereby vulnerable to messages about quote unquote fake news.
Think of what happened in the raid of a Kansas newspaper, of the Marion County Record, and what can happen, and that is, that's from when a police chief goes in and raids the local newspaper. I'm not good enough in my Kansas geography to know how close that is from you, but I assume the reverberations were certainly felt.
Certainly felt. It's not too far of a drive, and that actually ended up being a hopeful moment for me as someone who cares deeply about local journalism, which is why I got my start, in that the response throughout the state, throughout the country, even around the world to some extent, to stand up for the very brave editor and journalist at the Marion County Record, and to defend the right of the American free press, was actually quite heartening. The fact that this, you know, utterly unprecedented and in recent times unthinkable act had ever transpired, of the raid on this newsroom over, you know, grievances held within the, you know, some powerful people in that community, was also unsettling and potentially could be very chilling. And I'm sure that it relates to this media moment we were just discussing, that such a thing could even happen in this country today.
Well, I was one of many who got a subscription to support the paper. I still look forward to it whenever it arrives, and it's fascinating to read, and also fascinating to see how much is relevant to the community I live in on the East Coast. The book is fascinating. It's a It's a beautiful collection of essays, Bone of the Bone, Essays on America by a Daughter of the Working Class. Sarah Smarsh, I thank you so much for your time and for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Joe. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, Bone of the Bone. It is published by Scribner. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.